Well, we are finally here. I thought about something when I was sitting here. Tim doesn't know this, but he's so patient. He is so kind with me. It is unbelievable. I think maybe the week after last year's vow ceremony, I started talking to Tim about, we need to talk about what we're going to do for January 1st. So for a whole year now, he's been like, okay, Tori, okay, okay. He's so kind. So patient. So I love it. I think it's because I look forward to this evening every single year. Every year. From the time we were in Keystone, and we used to stand every time we did the refuges and precepts, but I just remember it was sort of the first time I had this sense of ceremonial aspect of practice, a sacredness about this practice. And so I get so overjoyed and overwhelmed with excitement. So I'm going to try to tone it down, but it's really hard for me to do that. But I only have a short window of time, so that's one thing that's helpful. So what we plan to do is I'm going to talk about sort of the teaching that we're going to do for the next year, for this coming year. And then we're going to take a moment, maybe about 15 minutes, and let people share some comments. And then Tim is going to do a talk on the refuges and precepts, and then we'll do the ceremony. Maybe have some silence and then announcements and ride share, that kind of thing. That's sort of how the evening will flow. We thought about me doing a talk and then him doing a talk, but we thought that it would be better if we had some way of having the refuges and precepts separate. So I'm going to talk about what we're going to do teaching-wise. So first, you know, this is an auspicious day. I mean, it was absolutely beautiful outside. And even though I spent the whole day in my apartment, I had all the windows, you know, the curtains pulled open, and I could see the sunshine. And, you know, this is it's like the beginning of a whole new year, whole new world, and it's the beginning of a whole new era for Sims. It's so auspicious that it's, I rarely let those kinds of things pass by. I try to make sure I do something or figure out a way to mark this so that I don't forget. Sometimes we can just get caught in our everyday lives and forget to pay attention to times that are so auspicious like today and this evening is. So Tim and I have this kind of difficulty because we're not the same. You may not have noticed that, but we're very different. So when we think about, Sims is used to having for 20 years, a teacher that had the same personality, same basic way of teaching, same style, and so that year after year, there's this sense of continuity that just comes whether we think about it or not. There was a continuity about coming to Sims. You kind of knew what the energy level was going to be like, and you knew what was going to happen. So then here you have me who's like, rah! Tim was much more steady and solid. And so we tried to think about how could we come up with a way to keep that same degree of continuity that you have with one teacher, even though you're going to have more than one teacher. And we thought that if we did it in terms of a theme, so the theme for this year is going to be the Paramis. We're just going to see if we can talk through the Paramis in a sense of awakening. And tonight I'm going to talk a little bit about how the Paramis fit in with our regular practices, all these practices that we're doing, and where do these paramis fall in there? They are also called the 10 perfections. I just like the Pali word paramis. Perfection just seems a little difficult for me, and so, but that's what they are, and we are trying to perfect these 10 qualities. Joseph Goldstein said that the Pali word, their paramis, refers to 10 wholesome qualities in our minds. So these are wholesome qualities that already exist in our minds, and the accumulated power that they bring to us. There is a sense that when these 10 perfections come together and accumulate this sense of power in our practice, in our everyday life, and how we move around. And so basically what we're going to try to do for a whole year is cultivate each one of these qualities and kind of bring that power together in our everyday life. Basically, from everything I read, you can, another way to think about these paramis is that this is what you would experience, these qualities, if you met an enlightened being, if you met a Buddha. These are the qualities of the Buddha. So if you're going to learn how to sort of be a Buddha, you sort of have to go into this from the sense of, like, get your instructions from the Buddha himself or from those wise, enlightened beings on what it is. Because I could give you my opinion about generosity, but the kind of generosity that the Buddha was talking about is not an opinionated kind of thing. Jack Kornfield says that one doesn't take a journey into the Himalayas without a guide who knows the ancient paths. And in a way, that's what we're going to try to do. We're going to try to take this ancient journey, we're take this journey into a world that does not, on its face, it's not based in what we normally think. I'm going to tell you what these paramis are, and then I was like, oh, I know what that is. I know what energy is. I know what strength is. I know what patience is. I know what truthfulness is. I know what renunciation is and virtue. I know this. But when we even think about it, we are limiting the far-reaching nature of what these paramis are. And so we're going to take each parami once a month. That's why we have this little card here, so you can see who's going to teach once a month. We tried to do it two months, but it didn't work towards the end. But basically, for 2 months, I'm going to work with a couple of paramis, and then Tim is going to work with a couple, and then I'm going to work with a couple, and we're just going to work with these paramis. And let's say a little bit about, like, where it shows up at. So as we sit here, we have all listened to talks and we have all practiced our sense of meditative technique. How do I practice this mindfulness or this meditation in a way that I can stay on the breath? Some people do concentration, some people do like choiceless awareness and vipassana. And then there are people that practice the mantras and chanting, and they practice invoking different gods and beings to try to embody that quality. And that's all meditation. Different practices, different people. Or sometimes we talk about suffering, and we practice with suffering. Just the nature of suffering, and where does suffering come from, and how does it show up? And we practice with the causes of suffering, and we just get into the minutiae of suffering itself, how it shows up. Or we might practice opening the heart. You know, how do I open the heart? How do I step into and escape the suffering without having to be reactive and do something about it, without it controlling our lives. So these are all basic practices, and there are list and list and list and list of things that we can do to practice around this area. The paramis, though, is the attitude. I think that's the best way I can think of it, the attitude that we bring into all these practices. We can practice all day long trying to get the technique down for concentration. But if you don't bring a sense of generosity into that moment, then what you have is technique, but you don't have that sense of awareness that the Buddha opened up, that huge, far-reaching understanding. And then when we go out in the world, I might can sit for a long time in concentration, but when I go out in the world, or I spend the weekend with my family, it's pretty ugly. I can't keep it together. I can't have a generous spirit, because there's some other quality besides just learning how to meditate, how to concentrate. There's something else that holds all of this together, and that's the paramis. Thanissaro Bhikkhu said that the paramis, they provide one of the few reliable ways of measuring one's accomplishment in life. And when you think about it, I'm particularly reading this because I've never heard of anyone talk about accomplishment in relation to practice. It's always like, oh, that just has a ring to it of striving and going against the practice. But what he says, he goes on a little bit further, and he says accomplishments in the realm of work and our relationships have a way of turning into dust. You know, we try to get these accomplishments, and they fizzle out. They don't hold any kind of value. They don't have a way. Just because I accomplished something, like I can think of, oh, I went to law school, and I accomplished that. But, you know, at this point in my life, it's nothing. But back then, it was great. But now, it's nothing. It just fizzles away, these accomplishments that we do for life in our relationships. But the paramis, these qualities of Buddhahood, once developed, are dependable and lasting, carrying one over and beyond the worldly winds of our daily lives or daily living. So basically, these paramis, as we begin to cultivate one into the next, they have a way of developing, as Joseph Goldstein calls them, that power that we then infuse in our entire lives. So I'll show you a little, I just want to take a moment and talk a little bit about how they interrelate with each other. Because the paramis, I read some stuff where people practice one at a time, but basically the bulk of the reading is that you practice these paramis, one leads into the next, leads into the next, leads into the next. It is a kind of a sequential way of practicing. And I'll try to see if I can explain how I see this sequence kind of working together and why it does. So we start with generosity. Generosity is kind of it's common for all beings. It's a common, anybody can start at a place of learning how to give and receive, learning how to be in that quality. So you start there, whether it's sacred or secular, you start with beginning to connect and understand generosity. And then you move into virtue, because it purifies the action of both the person who's giving and the person who's receiving. You begin to see in your generosity the character and the implications and intentions behind your giving, behind your receiving, so that you could begin to see more clearly what it is that you are, how you are moving in the world. And after virtue is renunciation. And I think of renunciation as that way of kind of like, kind of the antidote is a way to think about it. An antidote to virtue and generosity. Because we can get a little self-righteous with our giving and our receiving and our what we think of as this is the right way to live and everybody needs to live like this, and if you don't, then you're wrong. And so renunciation kind of is the stopgap that kind of helps us not fall too deeply into that self-righteousness that giving can kind of bring up. And it also opens us to wisdom, because that kind of giving, watching our actions, paying attention to whether we're causing harm, all of that, what renunciation does is kind of put a little bit of space there, some patience, some stillness into this otherwise generous nature that we cultivate in the beginning. It puts a bit of quiet and non-movement in there. And when you do that, it necessarily creates the opportunity for wisdom to arise, for this wisdom and understanding of how all of these things come together. I mean, on one hand, practice can sometimes get a little, oh, it's this or that, or I do this or I do that. But really, there is a continuity with all of this. And renunciation is what I think helps us settle ourselves so that we can begin to see the arising of the wisdom and insight into what we're doing. And then this wisdom, I didn't know this, but I read somewhere that one of the functions of wisdom is to generate and arouse energy. So it's sort of like we get these insights and have this wisdom intentionally to kind of arouse our energy, which puts us more into the practice, creates more desire, more intention, more willingness and wanting to practice, that kind of to look deeper, see more, practice, and not kind of lose our way. And into that wisdom, we look at energy, the energy that comes from it, practicing with that, which is then tempered by patience and truthfulness. That kind of, you're building up this energy, but there's a need to temper what it is that we are looking at, all of this together. This kind of building up energy, tempering it with patience and truthfulness, can create within us a resolve for practice, a resolve to stay connected to practice against anything that comes our way. And that resolve is what is the kind of the catalyst for the last two, which is the loving kindness and equanimity, so that our practice, we are resolved to do no harm. It's not some fleeting wish that, oh, I don't want to harm anybody, I'm going to start being a little nicer. It's an internal resolve to pay attention to how we relate to other people in the world, how we relate to ourselves. Where is my harm actually showing up? And to begin to look for our relationship with other beings. So So each month, we're going to look at this noble aspect, this far-reaching aspect of each one of these qualities, and see if we can't come up with some practices that support our ability to see out beyond just our everyday understanding. I mean, everybody here has an understanding of every single one of these qualities. But if the quality is nothing more than our everyday kind of haphazard way of looking at it, it's all limited by only what we've seen in the world. And if we haven't seen the far-reaching nature of generosity, or if we haven't seen what renunciation can do to help us and support us in wisdom, then we're so limited on what these paramis, our understanding around these paramis. So we're going to try to see, Tim and I are going to try to see if we can come up with some practices that will help us look beyond our everyday, ordinary way of looking at this. To the point where we can see a way to live in the relative world, but practice in the ultimate world. I mean, that is the nature of all of this work. It's not just that we want to somehow or another get out of the relative world and just live in this ultimate world of great beauty and love, kindness. That would just be a spiritual bypass, and we've missed the point of it. The point is, if a Buddha were to exist in this day and age, were to walk into America and walk across the country, there would be a sense of love and compassion to every person that Buddha met. There'd be a sense of equanimity and holding to every person that Buddha met. That is a quality that if we could begin to cultivate, it would be transformative in what would happen in this country. So basically, we're going to look at all these together and see if we can find a way together to connect with these qualities one after another. So I hope I see you, if I cannot see you on Tuesdays or see you here in the evenings, that you will listen to the talks and practice the homework, even if you listen by way of the internet. So let's take a moment. Sit here for a second. Pema Chodron said, "The future is completely open, and we are writing it moment to moment. There is always the potential to create an environment of blame, or one which is conducive to loving kindness. This year, let's work on an environment conducive to loving kindness."
It was really wonderful to hear all the different voices and just how the Dharma is wonderful like that, that we can each have our own expression of it, our own interpretation of it, and yet there's also something that's commonality that holds us in that field of the Dharma. And I'm very much looking forward to this year with Tueri's enthusiasm and passion coming out, and it'll be a good exploration for this year. So I'd like to move on to talking about the precepts and refuges. As Tueri is saying, this beginning of the year has this certain auspicious feel to it, like this freshness. I mean, sometimes we do kind of talk about the resolutions kind of with a little bit of hesitancy, but there's also this natural start, the new start of the year. It's almost like the past has been washed clean and it's time to move into a new way. And so this is a beautiful time to set our intention as Dharma practitioners. How are we going to intend to engage our practice? Like Michelle was talking about, how does my practice actually show up in my daily life? These are riddles that each one of us has to find for ourselves. We can, Tuer and I can help out, have guidance, other teachers can give guidance, but ultimately you have to make that connection yourself. So in a few minutes, we'll be doing the cord ceremony. And these cords represent a reminder for these intentionalities. These cords represent the cloth that a nun or a monk might wear. And they are constantly reminding of their vows, of their commitment to practice. And so this is a small way for us to remind ourselves of our practice. So these two aspects, the refuges and the precepts. So the refuges, what are we taking refuge from? What are we refuging ourselves from? We can think of it as this world of separation, of duality, of greed, of hatred, of delusion, of suffering itself. Taking refuge from the eight worldly winds of praise and blame, success and failure, pleasure and pain, fame and disrepute. So often we live our lives trying to control these winds, and we become buffeted time and time again. So we take refuge from that. The Buddha's teaching gives us a place of refuge that is unshaken, unaffected by these winds, no matter which way they may blow. And so what are we taking refuge in? This is what we're taking refuge from. And I encourage us to take a very personal interpretation of what that refuge may look like. Perhaps it's taking refuge in something greater than ourselves, something beyond this limited, contracted sense of who I am. These qualities of faith, of trust, of surrender. Perhaps it's taking refuge in this deeper understanding of how life works, how life unfolds and falls away, that we have experienced through our own practice. Perhaps it's taking refuge in wisdom and compassion, making a stand to live in those things instead of greed and hatred, instead of ignorance. And so important in this day and age. Perhaps it's taking refuge in this path of awakening, this path of liberating the heart, bringing each moment into the path. So as we take the refuges, the first we begin with this simple acknowledgement of the Buddha, an homage to the Buddha as an awakened being, someone that we hold as a guide, as a teacher. And then taking refuge in the Buddha, in the Dharma, in the Sangha. So we think of the refuge in the Buddha, we can, however you conceive of the Buddha, whether you conceive him as an ordinary person, a human being, who happen to have a deep understanding, a deep realization. Or on the other side, someone who is a deity or someplace in between. But really seeing where is your relationship to that. So often we come to this practice with a little bit of aversion toward worship or toward that sense of surrender. We like that sense of seeing for ourselves, which is very helpful. And yet there's often a point in our practice when we do have to surrender to something bigger than what we can conceive. A sense of trust and openness. We can think of the Buddha almost as a trailblazer who left marks along the trail. This is the way to go from our place of suffering, our sense of being swept by those worldly winds, into a place free of that, a place stable beyond that. So we can see those blazes on the trail to help guide our path. Because he was an innovator that saw beyond the normal convention, the normal way of seeing the world, the normal assumption of perspectives. He was able to see beyond that, to see the liberation that is possible in this very moment, to transform our lives. So the Four Noble Truths have that potential. in the sense of the Buddha, we can also include teachers who've gone before. In this way, we start to connect this seamless lineage from the time of the Buddha to the present day, from his students who became teachers and therefore all the way through to our teachers. This sense of connecting with what does that Buddha represent in your own experience, your own understanding, and having that willingness to allow that to evolve as time goes by. The next refuge is that of the Dharma. This is what the path points toward, the direction that the path is learning. How can we really understand what Dharma is? The Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, but also allow your mind to think beyond this Buddhist tradition to any place that the truth is shown. Any religion, anything outside religion, it's really one truth that everything points toward. And so as Dharma practitioners, we have the sense through our own experience what the Dharma is. So there's a sense of embodiment, a sense of understanding, some of the comments of how do I connect that with my daily life? How do I use my Dharma when work is so difficult, when life is so difficult? These are all ways of integrating the Dharma into our lives. So taking refuge in that, taking refuge in the Dharma. And the final refuge is that of the Sangha. The Sangha. I used to, sometimes when we were in Keystone, I would be running late because of work. And coming into that hall, it was like coming into this rarefied air of stillness. Because everyone was sitting with such sincerity, it's like you can clearly see that this is a different area that was created by the Sangha, as much as by Rodney. The container that we hold in this evening, in a retreat, in our practice, is held in part by the teachers, but also very much equally so by the students. This is the sense of Sangha, sitting in silence, sitting in dialogue, connecting around how do I integrate, how do I connect, sharing the pain that we all have, sharing the joy that we all have. There's a famous sutta where Ananda, the Buddha's attendant, turned to the Buddha and said, Blessed One, the Sangha must be at least half of the holy life. And the Buddha said, no, don't say that. It's the whole of the holy life. The Sangha is the whole of the holy life. So these three refuges of the Buddha, of the Dhamma, and of Sangha, this is what we take refuge in. Now, the other part of the ceremony is the precepts. And the precepts are these ethical guidelines, ethical container to help our actions be aligned with our wisdom, with our compassion. In a sutta from the Anguttara, the Buddha talked about the precepts as being of immeasurable benefit for ourselves and also for all beings. Immeasurable. Now, these precepts are always began with undertaking the training to refrain from. Undertaking the training to refrain from, which is different than shalt not. You know, it's not that sense of tension or a sense of sinning. It's that sense of really our own integrity that comes from our place in our heart. Our sense of integration of our heart allows our actions to be aligned with non-harm. So the five precepts, to undertake the training to refrain from killing or harming, to refrain from stealing or taking that which is not freely offered, refraining from sexual or sensual misconduct, refraining from false speech, and refraining from substances that can lead to heedlessness. So these five precepts, in a few minutes, we'll be chanting those. And these practices are very, you can take them as a practice that, you know, each day I reflect on where I am with these precepts. Which ones do I have an edge that I push up against? Which ones do I naturally align with? Because they're very comprehensive. They show us where our edges are in our life. There's many ways we can explore these precepts. But tonight I'd like to just, for a minute or two, talk about our relationship to stillness in relationship to the precepts. So the sense of stillness is this inner quiet, this inner sense of stability that doesn't shift with those worldly winds. Right? So we can be very still inside, very quiet, and still be very active in the world, very much doing our jobs, being with our loved ones, our family. Or we can be sitting very still and be completely filled with noise and agitation, a lack of inner stillness. So our relationship to stillness is often mirrored by our relationship with the precepts. See, the more unethical we are, the more we're causing harm, the more that we're stealing, the more that we're speaking falsehoods, at hurting with our sexuality or our sensuality, causing, taking that which is not freely given, intoxicating ourselves. The more that we do that, the more internal noise is generated. You can often see this very concretely when you're kind of faced with a little dilemma, ethical dilemma, like there's an extra cookie, right? You want it. It's going to taste good, right? So you can rationalize, well, you know, everybody's had a chance to get their cookies, and, you know, I've worked really hard. I deserve it. But you notice there's a lot of talk. There's a lot of noise that's generated as you come against that. But when you say, okay, I've taken one. That's enough. There's that sense of coming back into that ethics of not taking which not is freely given. It's hard to let go. But at the same time, there's a quiet that comes. There's a sense of stability that comes from that, that's unshaking. And that's often the test that comes again and again in our lives. You know, do I do something that's unethical and all the justification that that involves? Or do I know what's that still quiet voice that knows what's the right thing to do? And only yourself has that voice. Only you can know, look in the mirror and realize, okay, I have really lived an ethical life. Often there's a sense of rest, a sense of, yeah, this, I wanted that cookie, but this is the right thing to rest in the ethics. Now, the interesting paradox about this is that often we are very ethical. You know, as a group, we have actually a high standard of ethics. And yet, we sit and there's so much noise that comes up. There's so much agitation. I think it often ties in to our sense of deep guilt. Again, a deep shame that we carry. There's a sense that we've already broken some ethics or something that we're in trouble for. So it can be helpful to reflect on your ethical behavior, to reflect on how many times you are aligning yourself with these precepts, to rest in the bliss of blamelessness. There's a story that either Joseph told or Sharon told it about Joseph. That he was, I think it was Joseph, he was practicing in Asia and he was having so much, you know, a lot of self-dislike, self-hatred come up, and his teacher said, go to your room and reflect on your ethics. Reflect on your ethical behavior. And so Joseph went into his room, God, yeah, he's right, you know, I'm really not ethical. And it just got more and more contracted. And he went back the next day and told the teacher that. And the teacher said, no, you're supposed to think about all the good that you do, all the ethics that you do follow. You know, so there's such a tendency for us to focus on what's not right in ourselves. It's like it's a really strong bias that you need to start to distrust. You need to not take as being true. So really honestly look at how many times you actually act from kindness. You act from compassion. That's ultimately what these precepts are focused on. Living your life based on your wisdom, based on your compassion. Living with a kind heart in all actions of mind and body. All right, thank you. So now I'd like to move into the actual ceremony itself. So in a moment, Tweri and I will distribute these protection cords. As I mentioned, these cords represent the robes of a nun or a monk and the vows that they may take. And so this is, again, the sense of taking these precepts as a training, as a sense of, okay, I may fall down, I may fail. But it's this training to try to refrain from speaking untruth, to refrain from taking that which not is freely given. So I think we'll probably each take half of the room.
So the way we are going to do the call and responses, we'll say the Namo Tassa. I think everybody knows that. We can say that all together. We'll say it three times, and then we'll say it in English one time. Then we'll say the refuges in Pali. So that whole left side, we'll do it all at one time. And then we will do the English version all at one time. We'll move to the precepts, and each precept, there's one basic word for the precept, and we will say that, Tim and I, and then we'll do a call and response, and then you guys can say it back. But the Viramati, Sikapadan, Samadhi, Ami, I think we all know that, and so the first time you hear it, it may be a little difficult, but then it's the same thing every single time. So we'll do that all together. We will do all of the Pali, and then we'll go down and do the English version of it. All right? So please understand that you are free to say what you want and leave what you don't want to say. Don't say it at all. You don't have to say anything. So this is more of not you saying it to us. It is you saying it for yourself. All right? Okay, so let's begin here. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Homage to the Blessed One, the Noble One, the Enlightened One. Buddham saranam gacchami, Dhammam saranam gacchami, Sangham saranam gacchami, Dutiyampi Buddham saranam gacchami, Dutiyampi Dhammam saranam gacchami, Dutiyampi Sangham saranam gacchami, Tatiyampi Buddham saranam gacchami, Tatiyampi Dhammam saranam gacchami, Tatiyampi Sangham saranam gacchami. To the Buddha I go for refuge. To the Dhamma I go for refuge. To the Sangha I go for refuge. For the second time, to the Buddha I go for refuge. For the second time, to the Dhamma I go for refuge. For the second time, the Sangha I go for refuge. For the third time, to the Buddha I go for refuge. For the third time, to the Dhamma I go for refuge. For the third time, to the Sangha I go for refuge. All right. Panatipata. Pata viramati sikkhapadam samadhiyami. Adinadana viramati sikkhapadam samadhiyami. Kamesu machakara viramati sikkhapadam samadhiyami. Musuvada Viramani sikapatam samadhiyami siramiraya madhya pamadatana Viramani sikapatam samadhiyami. I undertake the training to refrain from killing. I vow to cultivate compassion towards all beings. I undertake the training to refrain from taking that which is not freely given. I vow to practice generosity. I undertake the training to refrain from sexual harm. I vow to cultivate responsibility. I undertake the training to refrain from harmful speech. I vow to cultivate loving speech and deep listening. I undertake the training to refrain from intoxication, which leads to carelessness. I vow to ingest items that preserve peace, well-being, and joy. So how about if we just sit here for just a few minutes? We'll just let this energy that's floating up all over the ceiling kind of rest upon us. The future is completely open, and we are writing it moment to moment. There is always the potential to create an environment of blame or one that is conducive to loving kindness. Pema Chodron. So thank you all for coming. I just have a couple of announcements.